You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and today I am talking to Robbie Collins. This episode is a breath of fresh air for you, recorded as it was before the pandemic hit. So there will be no pandemic chat on the episode itself, and I will try to keep any reference to it besides this sentence to a bare minimum. We're going to start before we get into talking to Robbie, who is just a phenomenal comedian. I was completely blown away by him when I saw his work in The Danger Zone at the recent Cape Town Comedy Festival. Robbie was born in Durban, based in South Africa. He's supported Trevor Noah for 7 years. He's been around the world with him. He's opened for Dave Chappelle. And we get into some of the lessons he learned from those experiences in the Insiders Club. 25 minutes of extras available to anyone that signs up at comedianscomedian.com/insiders. But we will be talking a lot to Robbie about depression, about life, about writing, about relearning how to socialise with people outside of the industry. That's a thing that we should probably talk about rather more often than we do. And we're going to talk about, do you remember the Ivan Aristigator episode? Wonderful Ivan from Venezuela, based in Melbourne now, and his incredible approach to translating the routines of the greats from English into Spanish in order that he understand them from the inside. Well, Robbie has a similar but very different narrative about his youth as a mega comedy fan, renting and re-renting DVDs in order to watch them back to front and really understand how it all works. So he's taken that obsession and has yet managed to turn it into an incredibly laid-back approach to his art. We will be talking a little bit about how he lets an audience come to him, and he really is a master at doing that. All of that coming up. I'm very quickly going to read out the names of the people who have been kind enough to jump on board the podcast recently. I just want to give a special mention to Jose Vizcaino and Sarah Nock, who both gifted subscriptions, and a man called John, whose surname I don't know if I should give you or not, who gifted 2 business lunches. More detail on them later. Thank you to everyone who's been doing those working lunches with me, and particular thanks to Jose, to Sarah and to John for their generosity in gifting subscriptions or other ComCom ephemera to other people, which is just such a lovely thing that you can do. Remember, you can join the Insiders Club at any donation from £2 a month to above, and we will, I think by middle of this month, we will have a proper gifting thing set up. At the moment, all you need to do, if you're already a subscriber, is go to there, open another subscription and send me an email saying that you would like it to be gifted to someone else, and I'll do that and set up a code for them. So that is that. Oh, and I want to thank Russell Hartup as well, who upped his subscription very kindly. New subscribers in the last week since we last spoke include Danny McBride, Alice Birdwood, Ross Drummond, Karen Martin Bond, Alan Wood, Neil Turner and Susie Lewis. So hello and thank you to all of you. Let's get into this episode with the fantastic Robbie Collins. So tell me about you. You're from Durban.
Right.
You grew up in Durban. You were born there?
Yeah, born and bred.
Okay. I don't know anything about Durban. How's Durban different to Cape Town? Is different to Johannesburg?
Durban's very different in so many ways. Like Durban has the highest population of Indian people outside of India.
Okay.
So Indian people, I don't know if you had a bunny chow yet.
No, people keep saying bunny chow to me. I don't know what it is.
Get a bunny chow.
Okay.
It's just like this curry put in bread. Finn, I told Finn about
it.
Finn
had it. He showed me a picture. It's half a loaf of bread scooped out and full of curry.
Yeah, it's genius. It's like, that's a very big thing. Like, Durban's famous for bunny chows.
Okay.
Because it's an Indian slave thing. It's okay. Not actually Indian, traditional Indian food from India.
Okay.
So, Durban, there's a lot of Indian people but I think you don't have anywhere else in the country.
Okay.
And it's the East Coast, so it's very warm, humid. The beach is amazing. You can swim in the beach throughout the year.
Okay.
If you're going to talk comedy, non-existence in the sense that there's really funny comedians there, but you'll get like one weekly gig.
Okay. Like you'll get a one weekly gig, or there is only one weekly gig?
Right now, as far as I know, there's one weekly gig.
Jeez.
Like sometimes you'll get, like end of the month, you'll get like maybe four.
Okay.
But otherwise, it's like...
And that's now, and you started 11, like 12 years ago.
Yeah.
So nothing.
Then. Back then it was horrible. Like back then, if you died on stage, I remember my first death on stage, because my first 10 shows were really good.
10 is a good number. Commonly on this podcast, being like, my first three, I killed. And then there's the one waiting for you where, like, you've been just gliding along with your tiptoes going, well, apparently this comes easily to me, yes. And it's waiting to smash you.
That shit was the scariest. Like, my 10th was just like, you know, when you bomb, and also it's the first time that it's happening to me. So I'm like, this is the worst shit ever. I did, like, I think I did 10 minutes of material in 2 minutes. It was just like, you know, you're getting thirsty, tired. You start thinking about...
Clicky mouth. Yeah.
Like, start thinking about all the things you could have studied. You're like, this is the worst shit ever. And I remember my mom saying, what is wrong? Like, where she wanted my uncle to come and speak to me because, like, you look very depressed. And I didn't know how to explain it to her because I didn't know what was happening. But at the same time, you didn't have a gig the next day to make yourself feel better.
You couldn't get back on the horse.
Yeah.
There's no horse.
You can't rush to another gig. There's no gig for the rest of the week. So like for 2 weeks, you're just sitting around depressed, rehearsing your sets in the mirror, like trying to figure out, fuck, like, how did
listening
I die?
Back to the recording of when it worked.
All of those things. So it's just like, that I remember just finding it extremely difficult, like wanting to grow but not being able to grow.
Yeah.
And that's the frustrating part, where it's like, for me, from my first stand-up gig, I was like, I quit my job, everything. I was like, I'm doing this shit properly.
What was your job? Was it a career job or just a job?
Oh, no, it was just a horrible, like, I did paper routes. I was an office clerk.
And you did one gig and quit your day job?
What? Before the gig, I was like, I'm out. Before the gig, I was like, I'm out. I was like, I'm gone, guys. I'm doing stand-up comedy. I'll see you guys.
But you're an actor. So this was like a fill-in job while you were being an actor?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. So you weren't like, I now have no means of making money at all?
No.
Okay. Were you a successful actor at that time?
I did like two successful plays. But I didn't really like it, though. I found in South Africa... At the time, there were a lot of plays that were all like struggle plays.
Sure.
As in plays that like had an apartheid story to it. And like it was cool, but a lot of it was like musicals. I can't sing, I can't dance. So I just found it very difficult to actually get acting work.
Okay.
But I got acting work, but it was just like, I didn't like the narrative of a lot of the plays that were out there. All the plays that were offered to me. So when stand-up came, I was just like, okay, cool. This is dope. I can just say what I want on stage. I can do, you know what I mean? I can feel it out for myself. But otherwise, before that, relying on scripts. I don't know if you feel it now. Have you done any acting?
Yes.
Where you, when you go from the stage to like a play or television or whatever, because you are now a creative going into something, you look at it differently.
Totally.
Like the script.
Yeah, I just imagined it then and I sort of shuddered a bit. I was like, what, I'd have to like put on a coat of someone else's stuff.
Yeah.
Be surrounded by someone else's stuff.
It's weird. And you read the script and go, people don't talk like that.
Yeah.
This shit is written by somebody who's stuck in their hotel or who's stuck in their house just writing scripts, but not actually seeing or feeling what people are feeling. Like, I think that's the beauty in comedy, is even if you don't know your audience, the response from an audience that agrees with you on something is like, it's the best feeling. When it's not even so much the laugh when they go, oh shit, yeah, I'm down with that. Like when I do my rhino joke, I don't know if you've seen it.
Remind me, which is the rhino one?
The rhino joke, just about like how people care about rhinos more than people.
Yes, yeah.
And like I can see it gets quiet And then when I do the punchline, there's a release of like, yeah. And that for me is so exciting. To say something that it's seen as controversial, but the right people get what you're saying.
Yes.
You know
yes.
what I mean?
And that's typified. That's your set all over. You know, your stuff about turtles. Like, you've got that lovely bit. You're talking about turtles. Help me help you, bro. Like, that, I don't want to butcher the bit, but like, we'll get onto that. I want to get onto the material.
Okay,
just
cool.
While we're starting with your starting comedy, what kind of childhood did you have?
Like I say, there's five siblings, five of us.
Okay.
Mom, dad, very religious home.
Mm-hmm.
But very religious home, but at the same time, also very lenient. You know what I mean? It was, I don't think we were really forced into anything, like to do anything. I think one of the only things you had to do as a kid was go to church on a Sunday.
Okay.
But apart from that, So
religious but not strict.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. There was definitely discipline, but it wasn't like your biggest responsibility you had was to make sure you went to church every Sunday
okay.
with the family. After that, it was fine. What you watched, you know what I mean? You could watch whatever. You could watch TV shows that had swearing
okay.
or whatever. It wasn't like a dictatorship. And I think then at age 11, my parents split up, and I stayed with my mom. And then I didn't actually tell you this. I actually have dyslexia.
Okay.
So my mom's a teacher. So reading was very difficult. And my mom figured out it's not so much that I can't read, it's that the books that they're giving me to read on things that I'm enthusiastic about.
Okay.
So she went out of her way and she got me like Jim Carrey books, Robin Williams, Eric Cantona.
Okay.
Like people I look up to.
Okay.
And I remember reading in Robin Williams' book when he talks about doing stand-up and like becoming a comedian. And that's when I literally remember going, oh, there's stand-up comedy.
Okay.
And then around the same time, Def Jam tape CD started being passed around like the neighborhood.
Yeah.
And then I remember seeing that shit like, oh, what the fuck? Like,
more so than the people around you? More so than your peers? Were you known as like, he's the guy who's really into comedy?
No, I was just known as the funny guy, not like okay. this comedian or whatever. But then like a couple of people would say like, oh, you should do stand-up or you should be a comedian. But I never really understood comedian. It would sound like, oh, this sounds like a cool thing. This sounds like a promotion to just being funny.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. So you were a funny kid. In what way were you funny? Were you funny like knocking authority? Were you funny at like roasting your friends? What kind of funny was it?
Roasting friends, mostly.
Okay.
Yeah. We didn't even realize that growing up that you were actually doing a form of comedy.
Yeah, right.
You're just like, let's see, whose turn is it to be insulted today? Like, okay. You know what I mean? Like, just tease a person. And I remember getting in trouble for just teasing people in class. But I just thought that was so funny.
Like, was it benevolent? Were you bullying anyone ever, do you think? Or?
Oh, no. I don't think so, because I was also bullied.
Yeah, okay.
So it was like, I just thought I was being funny. You know what I mean? And like the rest of the class would laugh. But I think that was like the foundation to doing comedy. And then after figuring out, going, okay, shit, I want to do stand-up comedy, like around 13, then I went out and just bought every bit of stand-up I could.
I love meeting a student.
I
love it. Some people wouldn't dream of doing that. Some people, it's like, obviously, I'm just going to hoover up everything.
Yeah, like everything. Like my mom and sisters have watched every bit of stand-up, eh? Like my mom can tell you about Bill Hicks.
That's so great!
Being there, like watching Bill Hicks documentaries.
Is that just because she was in the same room as you when you were watching?
Yeah.
Or is it to do with, like, she was good, what you say about, like, her getting you Robin Williams' book?
Right.
Do you think she felt kind of like, is that like a kind of long-term teaching kind of ownership, like he's into a thing and I'm supporting it? Or was she just like laughing along with you?
I think she started seeing how serious it was. I think when I was around maybe 17, 18. Before it was just, okay, there's stand-up on. Rob likes stand-up. But then she started seeing, oh, shit, okay. He wants to do this thing. and then started writing down jokes. Because I only touched the stage at 21, but like from 17, I was already, okay, I'm going to say this joke.
Okay.
Just writing out stuff.
What was your first joke you remember writing?
Oh, shit. I can't remember.
Do you remember if it was like an observation or a joke? Like a one-liner?
It was a joke. And also depending on who I was watching.
Okay.
So like if I was watching Bill Hicks, then I was like, fuck this. But not realizing what he was doing. Now when I look back at it, you go, there's art behind his attitude and his aggression on stage. Then I wasn't quite figuring out what he was doing.
Sure. And then you were just like, he's this cool rebel.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure.
It's like if you watch Kinnison, you just go, this person is angry.
Yeah. I understand this. It's an angry man.
Yes, that's... So I remember watching, Def Jam was very big, and then Kings of Comedy was very big, and then Seinfeld, started watching Seinfeld, because a cousin of mine had Seinfeld box set. And he was like, this is about a comedian, but obviously the show isn't really about stand-up. It's just showing how you can take life into stand-up if you watch it closely.
Yes.
So then I started picking up on that.
Yes.
And just watching the show more for just his intro and outro.
Yeah.
You know that little stand-up bit he does?
Yeah.
So watching it just for that.
Okay.
So trying to get something out of it. And then I had a period where I watched Whoopi Goldberg a hell of a lot. Like her Broadway shows, and I thought like her character was amazing. And then my brother, this way everything just goes. Pfft. My brother goes to the States to study in Boston. It's 2003, and at the time, Chappelle's Show comes out.
Okay.
And he just starts like every time he calls home, he's like, "Dude, you must see Dave Chappelle. Just see Dave Chappelle." I'm like, "What the fuck are you talking about?" Like, I know Chris Rock. Like, I'd watch Chris Rock. I'd watch Eddie Murphy. He's like, just watch Dave Chappelle. Then I watched Dave, and I was like, oh, okay, this is...
He's your guy.
Like, he's my guy. But in all of this, every time I watch a comedian, I go and read about them. And then in every bit of material I could get on them, everybody mentions Richard Pryor.
Yeah.
Richard Pryor changed my whole life. After I saw Richard Pryor, I was like, okay, game over. And I could literally see, I could see Eddie in him. I could see Chris. I could see Martin. I could see everyone like in this person. Like his topics, the way he moved on stage. And then I was like, oh shit, this is the person I need to study.
Okay. And that's a really great, again, it's that student thing. This is the person I need to study. So just talk to me about studying a comic. Like, what does that mean to you to study a comic?
For example, I watched so much Pryor when I started doing comedy. I used to perform with
an American accent.
that's funny. Because of Richard Pryor had a heart attack, right? Because of all his drug abuse and whatever. Richard used to do the, if you listen to Richard closely, he does a, so with Richard, because of his heart attack he had, the way he breathed on stage was because of that.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that. I even took the breathing. So I was literally doing the... And then eventually I was like, no, man, this is not how I speak. It's like, I'm only speaking like that on stage because of how Richard was performing.
Yes. How did you notice that? Did you notice that someone point that out?
I noticed that just because... I think actually a friend of mine might have said, hey, what are you doing?
Are you breathing like Pryor?
But they didn't know Pryor. So nobody knows where I'm getting it from.
Sure.
Because nobody, apart from, I watch so much stand-up. My mom's favorite comedian is Bernie Mac. Just from me watching.
What a sentence. My mom's favorite comedian is Bernie Mac. Oh my God.
Like, you wouldn't think, like, this religious woman and she loves Bernie Mac.
You don't understand.
Yes.
I ain't scared of you, motherfuckers. Thanks, mom.
So it's like, nobody was watching comedy. I was only watching this at home with my family or with cousins that would come around.
Okay.
But I wasn't, not like I got to the point where I wasn't even sharing DVDs with people.
Yeah.
I was like, this is my shit. I'm watching this over and over again. Like, remember when you'd go to the DVD store or the video store, mm-hmm. and then you could rent a film.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many places.
No, no, granddad, I've got no idea what you're talking about.
There's so many places in Durban where I owed them DVDs, where I'd literally go and rent the thing. If it was great, I'll go back the next week, rent it again, and then, like, that shit's not coming back. Like, I just watched it.
Presumably these places no longer exist because the market doesn't exist
anymore. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So you can never go back, like, you become super famous Chappelle level comedian and go back and visit and return your DVDs.
Yeah, I
that'd
wish
be a great tour.
Like, yeah, I'd go now, I'd go back and give them the money that
I
owe them, but like,
but they don't exist.
No. But I was also at the time, I was like, you guys don't.
And you took them out of circulation so no one else in Durban could learn about stand-up comedy. No, that's a tactic.
But it's also like, this thing is always, it's like, I remember renting Richard Pryor. Nobody was touching it. That thing was dusty on the shelf.
Yeah.
And then, like, it's so crazy because Richard Pryor live in concert, it's shot, what, in 1973, 75? And I remember watching it in 2005, and it was flawless. You know, when you watch a thing, and you can see just from, like, the footage, like, this is old. But watching it as a kid and going, this shit is hilarious. Like, yeah, Chappelle's funny, Bernie Mac's funny, but this thing, you could feel through watching it the energy and the time of it. Like, when Pryor was talking about, like, the great thing about Pryor is he doesn't talk race, but he talks race. Mm. Like, it's all his life, and he's making the shit that I went through. When he talks about the hiding, when he talks about the heart attack in the yard, you don't have to have the heart attack, but you see the thing.
Yeah.
And I think that's, like, for me, it was just so eye-opening because he just took every fuck up in his life and made a comedy gold. And it's like, who gets those kind of laughs from talking about having a drug overdose or trying to kill yourself, throwing, like, you know what I mean, lighting yourself on fire? How are you making a whole crowd of mixed people all just feel something and laugh at it? I was just like, this is, it was so genius to me.
When you had that period of, like, writing for 4 years before actually setting foot on a stand-up stage, Just spend a bit of time on that, because that's so unusual. You remind me, in talking about this kind of being a student of stand-up, you remind me of, do you know Ivan Aristegueta?
No.
Venezuelan act who's based, I think, in Melbourne now. You might have seen him. Have you been to Melbourne Comedy Festival?
I've been to Sydney and Perth.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe you've run into that. He taught himself comedy by translating the great routines into Spanish.
Oh,
and
wow.
In doing so, like, exploding the diagram of how it all works. Like, yeah. He's similarly kind of like, there's this, and what this guy does is this, and this guy's foundational premise is this. You know, kind of like diving in that, like, in a really, I guess, a similarly kind of a cerebral kind of way.
Right.
Or an even more cerebral kind of way, maybe. But I love the idea of studying comedy and what things you can get from studying comedy and what things you can't understand until you do it yourself.
Right. There's so many. I think with stand-up comedy, it was always like me. When I was writing material at first, and I was writing material that I thought was comedy, but wasn't really comedy. So I was trying to look. So, like, I was trying to, after watching Pryor, then I was trying to find every fuck up in my life to try and touch something.
I've got to set myself on fire. Yes. So I've got something to talk about.
Like, fuck, I'm happy. What the fuck is this? Like, I can't write comedy happy, like that type of stuff. And it was like trying to find every detail. Or then I remember watching, I can't remember which comedian, very political, like Rock is really funny, but he hits politics and he does it really well. But I was trying to touch a bit of Rock and go, okay, cool. Where can I find my equivalents to Rock politics in South Africa and make it funny? So there's a lot of things being taken, like ideas. Okay, you have a sex joke. Okay, cool. So what sexual experience do I have at this time in my life to also throw in a sex joke? So it was just trying to tick all the things.
Okay.
which is weird. You know, when you look back at your previous sets or how you're doing, you're like, I don't know how all this shit was funny. I don't know how I survived all this. But you guys laughed. But it was like, it had everything. Okay, and then there's this. And then, so we're going to do some politics for 2 minutes. Then we do sex. Then we do some hardship. You know what I mean? So it was all these different things, but it didn't have the right flow or click. And then the one day, I just started talking to a friend of mine about dropping out of high school, which is a true story. And then that just became a whole bit of like, okay, cool, this is what happened. Like
you got a sense of it being funny because you were telling him about it and he was laughing.
Yes, but I was just telling him. I just said, because now I'm doing comedy for like maybe 4 months. Doing comedy, staying at home with my mom. All my siblings have moved out. I'm still at home. And I'm just talking about like during the day, because it just felt like, okay, so I no more have a day job. I just have all this time on my hands. And then every week I go and do 15 minutes. And then for the rest of the week, I'm doing nothing. I'm just studying comedy, watching comedy. So then I just started telling him about like my day. And then that's when I started going, okay, here's my angle. You know what I mean?
I know what you mean, but what, like, I know what you mean, but just unpack what you mean. So like in terms of like, you're telling your friend something and you felt you were telling it differently to how you normally tell him something.
Yeah. But the way I was telling him, he was so interested in it because he was like, he knew what I was talking about, but he didn't know because he had a day job. He was in a serious relationship. So all these things I'm talking about, like how I need to make sure I wash dishes when my mom's out at school, how I got it, like all these responsibilities, but you're not getting paid for it. So it was like, yeah, you're pretty much running the house, making sure the house is clean and stuff. Because my mom was like, yo, I'll give you money to get to gigs. Don't worry, there's always going to be food on the table. But if you're going to do stand-up, do this thing properly. That was her only thing, her only deal with me. She's like, yo, just do the thing properly. Don't waste my time. And I was like, okay, cool. So she was like, okay, I'm not going to give you money to go drink at the comedy club, but you're going to get there and get home. So that was her thing. But so when I was telling him all these stories, I was like, I had so much time away from the stage that I realized that there's this whole bit that I was just missing. Like just the whole thing of not having money, staying at home with your mom, all these different things. But I didn't realize that was the comedy gold.
Yes, the problems are the material.
Yes.
You were thinking, I'm too happy, I can't set myself on fire.
Yes.
And then you kind of had an epiphany where you went, oh, actually, it's the real problems of my life.
Right.
That are the thing, the actual text of my life. It's not contriving some sort of problem to have.
Yes.
The fact is,
it's right here.
It's right here.
That's
a big moment, right?
It just clicked. I remember just looking at him face to face and just talking, and I just remember going, oh, here's the bit. Here's my angle. You know, when you go, here's the angle for people knowing who this comedian is.
Yes.
Before it was bit of Pryor, bit of Mac, bit of Seinfeld, bit of...
Sure.
So it was just all over the place. Yes, it still was funny, but it wasn't real.
And what do you feel... I mean, this is an impossible question, but what do you feel that angle is? What is it? What do you think we see when we see you step on stage?
I don't know. I think now I feel like people like me just... I hate saying, like, telling it like it is, because it just sounds so cliche. But I think people do appreciate the truth in what I say, and this is direct, but in the way I say it, it's like, I think most comedians do it, where you give somebody, you get this glass of water, you give it to me, but instead of just giving me a glass of water, you throw in some ice and a lemon.
Yeah, okay.
You know what I mean? It's still, not everybody's gonna taste the lemon, but the right people eventually will get that. You know what I mean?
So nuance.
The nuance, those little things.
And what do you think is your tone?
My tone?
Because, I mean, I've got some observations about your tone, but before I say them, I'm interested in what you think is your tone. Yeah.
I don't know, really.
Like, as opposed to Loy or Trevor or whoever, you know, what is it, when, like, what's particular to your tone?
Like, leaving aside the fact that when you walk on stage, you get 10 minutes of wolf whistles. Yeah, handsome guy with a dangerous-looking scar on your lip.
I don't know. That happened the past two nights, like, ladies
and
whistling.
A clip I saw on YouTube. You've clearly got gear about... There's a clip on YouTube on, like, I don't know if it's your agent's page or something, where you come out, everyone's wolf whistling, and you do, ladies, you're looking great yourselves. Well, not all of you. Boom. You
know yes.
So I'm like, oh, this clearly happens enough that you've written gear about it.
Oh, yes. I remember that.
don't pretend it's a freak occurrence.
I don't know. You know, it feels like, because even when, like, these chicks are whistling or whatever, and then they start whistling, but they want to start talking, I like seeing how that changes.
When you insult them.
Yes. That change of like, he's cute, but now his comedy, I don't feel like I'm trying to rely on looks.
No.
Like I've seen it with like some entertainers where you can see they know they're good looking. Male and female. And they're like, and they might not be doing it deliberately, but you can see there's reliance on appearance. And I don't think I'm doing that. I hope I'm not doing that.
No, I don't think so. No, and the fact that joke, and I'm sure there's other things you can say to them about the wolf whistles, but I feel like that specific joke of going like, you look great yourself, or not all of you, it's deliberately an affront, isn't it?
Right.
It's like, stop liking me for being pretty.
Yeah, I guess so. I don't think of it like that.
Yeah, I feel like whether it's intentional or not, I feel like that's the effect.
Yeah.
It's like, you're reminding us that you're not buttered up by this. Don't think we're friends now because you wolf whistled.
Right.
I feel like that's the message.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think that's exactly what I'm trying to say.
So your tone, besides that?
My tone? Shucks. I don't even think I can answer that.
Did you literally say shucks? I don't think I've ever heard a human being say shucks before. I thought that was just in TV.
Shucks is a very big thing in South Africa.
Oh, is it really? Okay, fine.
There's like a movie called Shucks.
Oh, no way. I wasn't aware of that context. To me, that's like a cowboy thing. Ah, shucks.
Oh, no. There's a comedic actor called Leon Chester who does all these like prank stuff.
Okay.
Like, I grew up watching a lot of his stuff. Okay. And He has a movie called Oh Shucks. It's just that.
Okay.
So like shucks was a... You'll hear a lot of South Africans say shucks. I think South Africans over 25.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I think when you come out on stage, you're tall and you're kind of rangy, but you have a sort of... I always want to say the word lugubrious, but I don't think it means what I think it means. So I don't mean that. You have a sort of languid... kind of quality, like right. You know, like Loy is tall as fuck and angular, but he's like a spider, right?
Yes.
Whereas you have a more kind of gibbon quality. You know what I mean? Like,
I
do you know what I mean? It's like an easy kind of slowness. Yeah. But I feel like you're stuck. You really let us come to you. Do you know what I mean? You're
right.
Not coming out throwing energy at us, going right. like me. You're going, I'm here. Pause, and we're like. Oh, and we all lean forwards, right? Do you feel that?
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. I feel that, but it's like, I think it's just some things I've learned throughout the years. When I used to open for Trevor, I remember like back in 2010 when I opened for Trevor and I used to go very fast on stage. I was very afraid of the silence. Like, silence for me was such a difficult thing. I'd speed up. And you know how it is if you're dying on stage... that joke doesn't work. Now you speed up trying to get to the next punchline. You end up fucking up the next joke because you're not respecting it. And then Trevor's like, yo, you speak so slowly off stage. Why are you becoming this other person? And then from then I was like, oh, okay, cool. And I think also opening for Trevor, I opened for him for 7 years. I think the first time I did it, I'd go quickly because I knew people wanted to see him.
Yeah, okay.
And I don't think I was confident enough to go like, yo, this is my time. Let me do my thing. But Trevor's very encouraging. He'd always be like, perform as if I'm not coming. Go and do your thing. Do your 12
that's
minutes.
That's great advice.
And then I think in the touring, like we're on stage every day to massive crowds, that's like, I think this is my second year in comedy. That's when
second year in comedy? And
yeah.
You're doing Trevor size, like what, arenas or like 1,000 seats, stuff like that?
So it's like theatres. So like where we at here?
Yeah.
So like we're doing like, I think Trevor's first tour, we're doing 600 seats.
Okay.
600, 400, 600.
Year two.
And I'm doing this
and
year
probably
two.
In year one, there's only one gig a month, right? Like, how many gigs had you done by the time you were opening for Trevor in a 600-seater? Had you done, like, 100 gigs or...?
Less than 100.
Jesus Christ.
Way less.
See, this is Robbie. What a joy. What a, his voice is just suffused with sunshine, and I'm loving the shucks here and there. It was so much fun talking to Robbie, and let's focus on what the world was back then, a scant 3 or 4 weeks ago, and not what it is at the moment and may become. Let's remember, though, that what it is at the moment, whatever else is going on, is full of joy and creativity. And if you are one of the people who has been joining us online via the ComCom Facebook group to take part in the various trials and tribulations of Stuart Goldsmith as he tries to pivot and create an online comedy club with genuine atmosphere, our Bristol New Material Night Chops is going to live again online. And thanks to all of you who, I'm recording this on Thursday, a few hours ago, people joined us. There were some wonderful acts, William Stone, Jenny Collier, plenty more besides. We had some really good gear. We were testing out whether we can use this particular technique that I have cut and shut together with the help of ComCom. I've got to give him a new role officially. There's a gentleman called Callum who is my Twitch and streaming expert. So thank you very much to Callum as the... what do we call him? The streaming consultant for now. So that has been going great guns. And of course, if you were part of the audience for Stuart Goldsmith's Infinite Sofa brackets working title, I'm creating a chat show format online in which you are the audience and the guests. And we can zoom in and interview anyone at any time. Rob Rouse was our first celebrity guest who very kindly took us outside in the middle of the night to look at his racing chickens. That will mean nothing to you, I'm sure. But if you're not in the ComCom Facebook group, you are not going to find the first opportunities to jump on board things like this and help me test out new things that will become further things online. It's with all due respect to the crisis that the world is undergoing, it is a really exciting time here at... it's not ComCom Towers, and I'm not sat in a van anymore. I've cobbled up a desk out of a couple of decking planks in my bedroom. So in the ComCom bedroom at the moment... there's a lot of exciting things going on, and I feel so lucky to be stewarding the ComCom community. And genuinely, I'm going to get emotional if I talk about it anymore. At the moment, everyone's online. Everyone's trying to help everyone else feel better. And I am so indebted to all of you who are connected either in the Insiders Club or in the Facebook group or just emailing here and there. Everyone's offering so much help, offering so many ideas and feedback, and we are all truly making something together in a way that I find enormously exciting, invigorating. And I never like to use the word heartening because I don't think it exists. I think the word is encouraging. Disheartening exists, but I think heartening is nonsense. But nonetheless, I'm finding it heartening. So thank you to all of you. You can join the Insiders Club at comedianscomedian.com/insiders. And here's a couple of other fun things that I've just invented, or invented for myself at least. Send me your messages. If you are listening alone, I spoke to someone earlier in the week who works from home, lives alone, and is completely isolated and hasn't really left the house apart from to... I mean, obviously none of us have left the house apart from to exercise and buy food. But... none of us in the UK. Hi to Richard in Sweden with your casual approach to wandering around. I spoke to someone who was particularly isolated, and it occurred to me, if you yourself are feeling particularly isolated, if you are feeling loneliness, feeling lonely, we often call that, you can talk to me. You can go to comedianscomedian.com/speak and use that. You just press a button, use your phone mic or your laptop internal mic to record a 2-minute message that I will answer on this podcast. I can't guarantee if it suddenly blows up and there's hundreds of them, I can't guarantee. But at the moment, it's not blowing up. So feel free to go to comedianscomedian.com/speak. Send me a message if you're isolated, feeling lonely. I will potentially get back to you and have a chat with you, but certainly use your message and answer it on a future special episode of the show. That's the plan. Similarly, if you are, and let's keep it within the realms of creativity, if you have come up with a particularly funny game to play with your neighbours on lockdown, if you're chalking things on the floor outside your house. If you are coming up with or have seen any particularly novel or creative solutions for some of the isolation a lot of us are struggling with, or just creative ways to school your children or source food if you're venturing into the wasteland and trading bottle caps for Stimpaks, I'd like to know about it. comedianscomedian.com/speak. And of course, finally, before we go back into this episode with Robbie, go to comedianscomedian.com/lunch if you would like to have a working lunch with me. There's a couple of different price points for if you are struggling at the moment or if you're comfortably furloughed and salaried. Very funny tweet. I can't credit this, but I always think of it now. I saw this 2 days ago. Stop using the word furloughed as if you knew what it meant 3 days ago. Great observation. Lovely joke. I'm sorry, I can't credit the writer. It's lost to the ephemera of Twitter. I'm doing these working lunches. I've done 6 or 7 of them now, and they have been so much fun. It's a sort of a new thing again. It's not me, but certainly the ones that have been professional and sort of comedy based, talking to comics who are 100 gigs in or so and doing almost like a sort of surgery with them, which isn't about writing jokes or rewriting jokes. It's more I sort of try and com-com them and try to get to the bones of whatever it is they're like, tease out the thing that they're struggling with that they don't yet know they're struggling with and try to give them some pointers to resolve it. Ben Milden was one of my first victims on that, and he gave me a lovely testimony. He said, thanks so much for what was an incredibly productive, useful and thought-provoking working lunch / therapy session. And I think that sums it up. So comedianscomedian.com/lunch if you would like to book one of those with me. They're loads of fun to do, and I'm finding them very stimulating and invigorating and all of those things. I'll chat to you in a bit of a post-amble after the episode, but for now, let's get back to this conversation with Robbie Collins.
How do you cope when things don't work? Like, how's your mental health? How are you at coping with the tougher elements of the job?
End of last year, I started seeing a therapist because I was feeling really down last year. It just felt like a tough year emotionally, even though comedy went really well. I was like, I need to actually do so. I need to make an effort to feel all right. That's something that I wasn't really accustomed to before. Where, especially with stand-up, you know how stand-up works. You're feeling down, you're on stage, you crush. You walk off stage feeling like life's perfect. And you just forget about everything.
This seems sustainable.
Yes, it's like, I'm good. People asking for pics. I've got a beer. You know what I mean? This is nice. There's ladies around me. Oh, this is nice. I'm fine. And then you go home and you... This might sound very depressing, though. But you go home and you're alone. And then you're like, okay. Eventually you fall asleep. Then you're in bed for half the day. You don't want to get out of bed. You're feeling depressed again. The high's gone down. And that sort of became a routine for me. And then eventually I was like, no, I don't want to. The stage can't be the only happy place, man. As much as I love stand-up, you can't live life like that. It's way too much. Like, I've made an effort this year and end of last year to have friends and a social life out of the comedy club.
Like, I love the idea of making an effort to do that. Like, not that it's necessarily hard, maybe it is hard, but given that comedy can absorb you when you're an obsessive like you, me, it can absorb everything.
Right.
To remember, well done, for congratulations for spotting that is not necessarily healthy or sustainable. Yeah.
It's like, I love my comedian friends, and I've made very close comedian friends over the years. Like, I think why you click with comedians is because I've known you for a week, but I know so much of the shit you've gone through.
Yeah, right.
Just from stand-up.
Yeah.
We've shared so much already.
100%.
Just from the craft we do.
Yeah.
And I think that's why we click quicker, because you can walk into the room with Eddie Murphy.
Yeah.
And he knows what you're going through, and you know what he's gone through.
Yeah. So,
and immediately, that's such a great connection. I remember I had these arguments with my ex-girlfriend, and she'd be like, show ended at 10:30. Why are you home at 2? It's like, yo, the stage is the practical. Off stage is the theory. I need to be around these people. comedy is a lonely thing. So if I'm not hearing your stories about how the guy didn't want to pay you or this gig was horrible, I'm just thinking that I'm living in the shit by myself. You know what I mean? And then you hear another comedian who's doing better than you, maybe financially or whatever it is, but you're just hearing all these stories. You're like, yeah, okay, I'm not alone in this.
The stage is, tell me that again, that was brilliant.
The stage is the practical.
The practical.
And the off stage is the theory.
Yes. And then you have to have both those components.
You have to. Those conversations with comedians after a gig, Jesus, like those conversations have like saved me. Like, we're just listening. Like, Loy, before I went overseas, and Loy and Trevor were the guys who were going overseas. But whenever they'd come back, or Loy would come back, especially, like, you just tell me these crazy stories about the road and, like, overseas, London or New York. It's like, oh, shit, okay. And, like, you're just hearing all these things, and it's so important to go, okay, there's somebody next to me who I know is doing this.
Yeah.
It's like, this shit isn't that far off.
Yes. And even, like, just with those things of envy, of, like, when you see other comics who are doing great, and then to hear from them that, like, oh, this opportunity I have is because I worked for it for 5 years. It's always been my dream project. And I,
right.
You know, and you go, oh, right, yeah, it was when I just saw it outside, it just seemed like something had fallen in your lap. And now I realize it's part of your narrative and it's a big deal to you. And
right.
Like that. All of those things make you kind of go, oh, right, this is, you know, because we live in such a, we all have to self-promote.
Yeah. And like for me personally, I'm really making an effort to promote on social media. But I just find social media, it's almost the way you got to promote yourself. Like, so a friend was saying to me, like, you can't just post on your Instagram posters of gigs when you want people to come to gigs. People want to see your life and feel like there's a connection to come to your gigs. And like, fuck, when I'm on stage, I talk about my life and stuff. If they come to the gig, they'll know about me. Then I thought about it more and I was like, okay, I understand if I want you to give me 150 rand, what's it, 15 pounds. If I want that money from you, then I can't just come to you when I want cash.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Like, there has to be an investment in it, you know? So I do understand it more and I'm trying to make more of an effort, but, I don't. If I didn't do stand up, I don't think I'd have social media.
Yeah, same. And if you started 11 years ago, you didn't start it in order to do social media. You started it to gig, and it's become this inescapable.
Yeah,
part of it.
Like Facebook was a thing. Facebook was just coming out, so Facebook was so like family orientated, and it was cool to have, but it wasn't like this. If you don't have this shit, you don't have a career type of thing.
Mm.
Now it's very much like, yo, if you don't have that, they're going to forget about
every
you.
Every time someone invents a new app, all comedians are like, oh, fuck, this is real.
That TikTok thing. I was like, I'm not even entertaining that shit. Like, I was like, I'm hoping it disappears as quickly as it's coming. It's like, I think Instagram is probably the best because Instagram has everything. And then, like, the pictures, captions, and what the captions, it's pretty much like the Facebook status.
Yeah. You can basically put a tweet on Instagram.
Yeah.
You can't really do it the other way around.
Yeah. And I haven't been on Twitter since 2017. I just find it to be a negative, negative place. It's like, I don't want, like, I remember once, this isn't the reason I stopped, but I remember once walking off stage and checking my phone to make notes, and then on Twitter somebody had already tweeted at me. Like, literally in like 2 minutes.
Yeah.
I think they did it while I was still on stage. And I was like, no, man, like, this is just, and it wasn't a positive tweet. I remember just like, the fuck is this? Like, watch the thing. I can see when you tweeted this, if you put your phone away and actually watch the thing,
yeah,
I think you'd have enjoyed it more.
Yeah. Yeah. So what kind of negative things are you specifically battling with in the world of work, in terms of your comedy? What, like, when you started seeing a therapist, are there ramifications for your comedy practice that you're grappling with?
No. I think it might just be... Maybe relying on comedy too much.
Yeah.
Not so much the craft, like... I know things, you'll have your bad gigs. I'm past that point.
Sure.
You know, some months are better. I know that. I think the thing is relying too much on it, making that the only focal point.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm from Durban, and I was just thinking about it. When was it? Beginning of February. I finally went down to Durban just to see my mom and chill. Before, for the past 6 years, I've always gone to Durban because I was booked for a gig. And then I'd fly in earlier or a day later just to hang out with my mom.
Yeah, that's a good point, yeah.
And you go, okay, so my relationship with my mother is based on my bookings.
Yeah.
Yeah. Obviously, I still speak on the phone, but I'm like, the times I see are based on my bookings. Like, that's when you go, okay, actually, that's something's wrong with that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it seemed cool, it seemed convenient, but that's not how it should be. Like, if you got some free time, then go out and hang with your mom or whoever it is who's important to you.
Yeah.
And I just thought comedy was dictating too much of my attention. Or depending on what I give my attention to.
Have you found it hard to make friends outside comedy if you're deliberately starting new friendships outside comedy?
No, because I actually, you know what it is? It's because comedy's also given me so many friends, even who aren't comedians. So you know a lot of people. But the thing is, that's always socialized within comedy. So it's we're here at the pub next door to the comedy club because you came to my show. So it's not like I went out without touching a comedy club, touching a mic, or even going near the comedy club.
Mm.
It always starts with, okay, comedy club, and then we'll see what happens next.
Yeah.
So
trying to stop that, you've got to relearn how to be how to socialize.
But then at the same time, just if you the only comedian hanging out with a bunch of normal civilians,
they're worse.
Jesus. Like some of them are like you know when you do it.
No, I don't mean you. If you're listening to this, I don't mean you personally.
You know when you do a joke like with normal civilians and you go, shit, this would have killed in the comedy, like with a bunch of comedians. Because with us, everything goes. Like if you think what a comedian says on stage is hectic, go and listen to comedians backstage. There you'll hear like the craziest shit, the stuff that's not yet the stuff that we want to do on stage, but we're not confident enough to do on stage, and that. Backstage is it's wild.
I always remember there's a comic actress and writer in the UK called Katie Wicks, and she's a friend of mine. Another podcast, she was saying about how you'd be with a partner, she'd be with a boyfriend or a friend who was just going, "Oh, I don't want to go and hang out with you and comedians because all you do is stand in a circle and try and top each other's joke." And she's like, "Yes, it's the best thing in the world." You know what I mean? Yeah. Sorry, you're
going. No, Gary, I'm listening.
Well, I just think, but for all that we say that laughingly, it is important, right, to have a real life.
It is.
That's a really good point. Going out, not after a gig.
Yeah.
Just going out.
Just going out, like going for dinner, whatever it is, and just leave, like... So many times with comedy, and I promise you, I blame social media for this shit. Social media creates this thing of if you're not there or you're not doing something, you're missing out drastically.
Constantly.
And it's like how many people are posting things and then there's the story. So it's like, so you're seeing every little thing. If you're having 2 days off in a week and you're just chilling because you need to do that personally. You can't go on social media and if you're not strong enough because those people make you feel like you're throwing your life away, like you're wasting time. And it's...
Absolutely.
It's so horrible. Like, if I had like teenage kids, I don't think I'd let them have social media just yet.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like it's a lot of things. And the same way it puts pressure on kids, I think it puts pressure on adults. And if you have a career like comedy, if you see people doing this gig and that gig, you literally feel like your career is going to shit.
Yeah. Yeah, because the nature of it, the nature of the algorithm or whatever, it's designed so that you see the best, most exciting things. You don't, on social media, you don't watch one individual comic have a week of like having a great gig, then a night off, then a fight with their parent, and then a... you know, and then another gig, and then lots of not so good gig. You don't see that. You just see the very top highlights of everyone, and you end up thinking, God, everyone's enjoying themselves. Like, the whole point of social media is to leverage fear of missing out, you know, leverage FOMO in order to make someone else a billionaire. Like, oh, well done, that's a really good trick you pulled.
Totally.
But you know, I can think that logically and then still glance at something and then get completely sucked in into feeling like a loser.
Totally. Like, when I post like stories, if I had a bad gig, I'll say, totally bombed today. It was shit.
Yeah.
Like, I'll be the first person to say I bombed.
Yeah, good for you.
Because I'm like, because no, you know, the other thing is like, if you're only going to be posting how great you are, your comedy is, or everybody you're with is just killing, you're not really explaining live comedy.
That's true. I'm going to start doing a new thing inspired by this conversation. Whenever I see someone's success on social media, I'm going to click on their profile and look at their 10, 15 most recent posts. And if there's no failures, I'm going to stop following them. That's my new system. And I'm going to apply that to my own output as well. Because what's the point? Because otherwise you're... All right, you know, put them on a list of like... you know, Bobby Dazzlers, whatever. But they're not real people. Like, you don't have to compare yourself to anyone who doesn't put any failures on social media.
Right.
That's a good... That is... I mean, that feels like the solution. That is the absolute bare minimum we should all be doing.
Yes. Like, if people... I think we'd all be learning so much and all be so much more relaxed if we're actually telling our... talking about our failures.
Yeah.
Like, if you're like, yo, that shit didn't work. That was horrible.
And that's what we should be doing on stage. That's, you know, that's what we came back to. We were talking at the beginning of this, talking about the time you set yourself on fire.
Yeah, it's like, you know, like when people are in relationships on social media, you see everything about the relationship.
Oh God, yeah.
We're in Bali, we're here. Like, I feel like after people break up, they need to post a picture together. Just like
this is me staring out the window, missing them,
and explain what happened, because I feel like I'm so invested in your bullshit. Tell me what happened. Who fucked up? So,
what are your? We'll wrap up shortly. What are your? What do you see as your superpowers in comedy? Like, what are you particularly good at?
I think storytelling. I think storytelling, definitely.
And what is it you know about storytelling that makes you good at it?
What do you mean?
Well, like if you had to, say you had to talk to you 10 years ago and shortcut your learning about storytelling, like what would you say? What is it that you've discovered about storytelling or that you know naturally, just in your bones, that makes you a better storyteller than the next guy?
I think... not relying just on facts of the story. I think in storytelling, there's so many different avenues. Like, so many times, I remember when I tried to start doing storytelling back in the day, I was like, facts, this is exactly what happened. This is doing that with, you know what I mean? Where I thought if I beefed it up, I was lying to them. They're like, no, I'm not lying to them. I'm just trying to make you come into my world more.
Yeah.
That's all it is. And I think when you paint that whole, when you show people that side, like, hey, man, there's so many times in comedy you need to do things just to get them in it. And then you can go wherever you want. So I think it's just being comfortable with beefing it up just to make my world more accessible to a stranger in the audience. I used to do this joke about my cousin's attempted suicide. Fuck, I used to love doing this joke. So my cousin tried to kill himself. So the whole joke was like, so cousin tried to kill himself, and I forget how it goes, but how he's over it now. He went for counseling, he's dating again, he's doing well, but he's forgotten all the shit he's put us through. Because it's a hectic thing when somebody tries to kill himself. Mm. But he's got, like, he's doing well personally. But we look at him like a hazard. Like, we don't trust him in the house or whatever. So it's just like, it's like this whole thing of, like he can't go into the kitchen to make tea for himself because everybody's like, what's he doing? And just, it's just like messing with him. Like, while we're chilling, watching TV, I'm just looking at him like, hey, Brian. It's like over the top. But I realized in that joke, before, that joke couldn't stand alone.
Mm-hmm.
So I had another joke, which wasn't the same cousin, about rich relatives that you always thought they were better than us. So you go visit and they always had like, they didn't, like my cousin wouldn't let us play with their toys because they thought we were going to break the thing or whatever. So then I combined that two shit and then to make it, so made that cousin who attempted to kill himself be part of the rich family.
Yes.
So once you build that joke on the rich family and where people are laughing and they're like, yeah, we all know that rich family member that's an asshole.
Yes.
They get that. And then, so then the way I linked those two jokes is like, they were always better than us. Until the older son tried to kill himself. Then the crowd goes, but now it's a laugh. Before it wasn't a laugh.
Yes, okay.
Because
yes.
Now they go, oh, okay, okay. We see why there's a victory in this man's attempt to suicide.
Yes, yes. A victory for you.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Yes, okay. So because that,
standing alone, that shit is like, wow. Hey, man, the person tried to kill himself.
Sure.
And it's also not like, it's not like I try to kill myself where it's self-deprecating. Now I'm making fun of some, that's a, to try and end your life, that's a hectic thing you're going through. But I was like, I need to make this thing work. So that joke, the suicide joke, the first time I did it just without the rich family and killed. And I was like, oh shit, this thing's funny. Did it again, bombed. It was like ruining my sets. Like after I do the joke, it was literally like, you know, like you can be on like 100%. That joke would take me to like 10. Where the crowd was like, what the fuck is happening?
But you knew, but it had killed once, so you knew there was a way.
There's something, but I was doing something wrong. Then I realized, a friend of mine, comedian, he was like, you're not smiling when you say it. He's like, it's way too serious. You're laughing, but you're not smiling. You're not over it. It doesn't look like you're over it to us. So we can't join in on this thing.
Okay.
You're not assholes. So I was like, okay. Then I realized that. So even if I fake giggle, and then now I have this other joke, let's combine the thing. So now we show, oh, this person is a human before he tried to kill himself. So we get that out the way.
Yes.
And also, let's not act like he's never been an asshole.
Sure. So it fleshes, it fixes so many problems.
Yeah.
Just the collage of those two bits together.
Yeah.
The action of one upon another.
Right.
So, do you ever see other comics telling stories and have a sense of why they don't work as well?
Yeah.
And what is the mistake
that you see?
No, this is a place to talk about it. What mistakes do you see people making? I'm asking, I think it could be useful for comics who are storytellers listening to this, if you can identify the most common mistakes you see people make when they're telling stories that don't work.
The laziness in thinking that people are already in your world. That's a big thing. Wherever you are, even being here, like I'm from Durban, but I must still explain my world to them. Before I can take you into stealing chips in the kitchen, I got to explain how I even got there. My mother's a nun. Like, let's break it down before we even get to chips. So if I just started talking about stealing chips, I'm like, yo, what household did you grow up in? But there's a point now why we trying to steal chips. You know what I'm saying? So there's, I think the laziness in trying to get your audience to that, to where you want them.
Okay.
just expecting them to be there and know what it is. I think there's, I think a lot of comedians don't, in that laziness, it creates a lot of silence because you're, in your story, your punchline at the end of the story is your only bit of humor and maybe a couple giggles. If you went out of your way to figure out how to explain the shit properly, you'd probably add in another 10 laughs, big laughs. But it's just like, oh, now you're just telling us this very dramatic story and we've got to wait, what, 3 minutes to laugh? You don't know, man.
It's interesting that, yeah, I don't disagree with that at all. I think that's very astute. It's interesting that you call it laziness rather than maybe the comic not realizing that they have that opportunity or getting caught up in...
You know, I call it laziness. If you went on stage every day, you would have figured that shit out. You would never go on stage every day and talk for 3 minutes and not get a laugh. And maybe when you hit the punchline, not get a laugh. You would figure that thing out. So the laziness is not even being there to learn the shit.
Yeah, right.
You know, like that, yeah, quote, inspiration can only find you when you're working.
Yeah.
You're not going to sit at home and write the next best thing, best joke. Like, you can be sort of prepared, but the stage is where, like, all the... I was telling a young comedian, he was asking me a lot of questions 2 weeks ago, and I said, after giving him advice, I said, use this advice as long as it serves your purpose. You're going to find your own advice. Like, every comedian that's given me advice, older comedian, the advice worked, but I've actually given myself the best advice that I needed. Because if you're in the space, you go, oh, Rob, this works for you. This sounds cool. That advice you got sounded cool, but you more of this person. And that's fine. It's like, these rules are here to be broken and changed.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I'm a big fan of Quincy Jones. I really do like music, like especially a lot of jazz and stuff. And Quincy Jones was talking about, like, just making music and all these songs he's produced. And he always says, like, he always leaves a song at, like, 80%. And then he leaves 20% for God to walk through the door and just sprinkle some magic. It's like, as prepared as you think you are, you can only find the shit if you are in the studio. You can only write Thriller if you're in the studio. Working at it. You can only find that next joke on stage. And I think it seems like it's difficult, but it's so simple. Like, these people are on stage. Like, you know, when I was touring with Dave Chappelle, he'd do a show and then go to the comedy club and try out his set. It's the same thing from a sold out theater. You know, he's in the comedy club at 2 a.m. smoking a cigarette and figuring out things. And you go, oh, okay. So, like, if this person's still doing that, who the hell am I? Like, you know what I mean? It's like that whole, you can't beat comedy. You can't cheat it. Even if you are cheating it, it will eventually win. I've seen that happen. In 12 years, I've seen so many comics disappear, man.
Like, yeah, really.
Comics who are, like, the guys. And, like, they're where are you now?
Because...
try to cheat the thing. I'm telling you, it will humble you, dude. That's why Eddie Murphy says in interviews he's terrified to do this thing. Because he knows, doesn't matter how much money Eddie has, he has to go back to the drawing. He needs to be in the clubs.
He's got to go and fail.
He needs to go and fail. He needs to be there every day dealing with bullshit, figuring that shit out. So, like, you can't cheat the thing.
And what are your weaknesses as a comic?
Can't do accents. Don't even do voices, really. I think I could be a bit more animated. Like some jokes, I do them, I'm like, if I did a little more of a thing here, it would have been better.
And what do you see? Is there anything you see other comics do that you think, I wish I had more of that?
Oh, yeah. There's certain comedians you watch, like, shit. I don't know if it's more of that, but it's like there's certain comedians I watch, and I guess we all have it, where you watch a joke and you're like, Jesus, oh, if I only thought of that thing. Like, you know, like that joke, wow. I'd do anything for just that joke.
What's your favorite one of them?
So as I'm trying to, like, saying that, I was like, trying to think of it. Oh, I have this friend, because in South Africa, it's not like, in England, you have school uniforms.
Yeah. Sometimes.
Sometimes, yeah. There's a comedian from Zimbabwe, and his birthday is the 11th of January. And he just, it's a really good story, but he just talks about how he's sick and tired of his mother. Because he found out that kids get presents for their birthdays. But in South Africa, the new school year starts in January. So he always got a school uniform or school shoes. So but the way he paints the picture, it's brilliant. It's just like how he talks about like going to a birthday. And there's a jumping castle there, and there's sweets, and he's like, oh, like just the way he does it, like I'm gonna mess it up. But like when it's one of those jokes, like when he's in it, and I've seen it quite a few times now. But you know, you're watching him, and you're watching the audience so involved in the joke, but they don't even know what's coming next, and it is cool to watch. It's cool to watch knowing that what's gonna come, but it's just like he's killing this.
Who's it? What's his name?
Baxter.
Baxter?
Yeah.
Okay.
Very, very funny.
Finally then, what do you want from comedy?
Oh, it's a tough one. Personally? Or like, what do I want to leave in comedy or what?
That's a good question.
I think personally, I think comedy is something I want to be doing forever. I'd like it to keep making me happy on stage and just in general, but being able to provide whatever I need for me and my family, like things like that. But comedy is crazy because I've traveled so much and I've done so many different things. And if it wasn't for comedy, I'd have never. Like, where I think about, like, just sitting in this room doing this with you, like, my friends who have normal day jobs would never think of doing this on a Saturday afternoon. You know what I mean? Or having the opportunity.
Sure, sure.
To just talk about things. So I'm very grateful for, like, what I've seen and just people I've met from comedy. I think what I'd like to leave from it, in comedy is probably, like, I know, like, I don't know. I feel like if I had to stop comedy, if something had to happen to me where people would feel like something was missing if they had seen me before. Does that make sense?
Oh, if something meant that you couldn't do comedy anymore, people would be gutted. Because yes. They'd be like, oh, I never got to see him.
And we enjoyed his opinion and voice.
Yeah.
Like there's something missing from how we laughing. Am I making sense?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, that's a really, no one's ever interpreted that question before as what do I want to leave behind? And I think that's really, that's a great angle on it, you know.
Yeah, because why are we doing it if we're not going to be remembered?
But no, I mean, my feeling on that is no one remembers anything. Given enough time, even statues crumble.
Totally, but I think, and when I say remembered, don't have to be freaking the best to ever do it or whatever. It's just your influence, how you've impacted people.
Yeah.
Where you'd be, like, what makes you remembered is how people talk about you. You know, like, I don't have to see certain comedians, but I've heard comedians talk about them. Like, there's a comedian, Wavin Dawson. He was just before Trevor. He was meant to be one of the big dudes. I've never saw him. And he passed away. He had a car accident coming back from a gig.
Mm.
And every comedian who talks about that dude, just like, it's just praises. It's like, he was meant to be the big guy and then he died. But like anyone who saw him, like even people who went to the clubs, like, and I've made a couple of friends, audience members, and the way they speak about him, like, yo, dude, this guy was like the shit. So those kind of things are cool. I think comics when they come and go, comedy stays, but it's just like everybody, you want to kind of put your Lego piece to the bigger picture, you know?
That's nice.
Like, it's weird. We need each other for our industry, all comedians. Like, when I see some comedians with stupid, like, arguments or beefing, I'm like, but you need each other. Like, this whole thing needs each other.
So, one day, a kid in Durban stealing your DVD from Blockbuster Video.
Yeah, sucks. Actually, I must actually check in my mom's place. I think there's a lot of them there. all not in their original covers. Because, like, when you rent, they don't put the original cover. They don't give you the original.
Oh, you've got the Blockbuster covers?
Yeah.
You need to throw them away and put them in one of those briefcases with all the compartments.
Yeah, yeah.
Thanks, man.
Thanks so much, dude.
So that was Robbie. Hugely grateful to him for coming along. I hope he's safe and well and isolated wherever he is. And just what a, oh, I love it. I love it. What a great interview. I don't mean a great interview. What a great conversation. Like, I love all that sort of obsession. I love when people are kind of self-taught students of comedy, like not just doing comedy, but really a student of comedy. That really speaks to me. And just, oh man. Yeah, great. Well, that was a good one, wasn't it? And it was really nice. So just the idea as well of recognising that comedy and mental health issues, challenges, can be parallel and lifestyles, and recognising that lifestyle and recognising the link between them, and needing to chat to other comedians to feel less alone, and recognising that that isn't necessarily helpful. So just loads of great stuff there. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. Thank you to Robbie for being on the show. That one was recorded at a big posh hotel in the heart of Cape Town, so I don't need to thank anyone officially for that. But I will thank podcast consultant Peter Dobbing, Rob Smouten for the music, producer Nathan Wood, who is doing great guns with ancient and creaking tech at the moment. If you are in or near Newcastle, where Nathan lives, and you have a spare Windows laptop or PC that you could loan him short term, well, maybe for the duration of the pandemic before he can get his actual stuff fixed, then the podcast would be in your debt. So if you are in or near Newcastle and have a Windows laptop or PC to lend, give me a shout, info@comedianscomedian.com. I shall hook you up with Nathan, and you can do some sort of absurd leaving it in a safe in the street for 24 hours and then he can collect it, or whatever that thing is you can organise between you. But we'd be, he and particularly I would be enormously grateful for that, because his work is absolutely vital to the continuing production of the podcast. So that's all of that. We'll have a very quick postamble, but I've been absolutely hammering it all day. Have you finding this? I've never been busier. I've never been busier. I'm always online and everyone knows I'm always available, and it's killing me. We'll get into that in the postamble. But for now, thank you to Robbie. Thanks to you for listening. Remember, comedianscomedian.com/insiders to join the Insiders Club, /speak in order to leave a 2-minute message that I can use on a future podcast, and /lunch in order to book a working lunch. Thank you, all of you. At ComComPod on socials if you would like to speak to me via those, and watch this space, join the Facebook group for more online jiggery pokery as we try to work out, and it really did, the chat show, it's still up there, we've left the video up there, if you've not seen it, fill your boots, because that has got a lot of potential, and I basically get to be Kermit in the Muppet Show, which is all I think I've ever wanted. Bye for now. So listen, this will be a hyper-speed postamble, because honestly, I've never been so busy. I'm sitting here at this homemade desk with two composite decking planks, literally parcel taped together. One of them is balanced on a tub, a hermetically sealed tub with a PlayStation in it. Ha! Very different lockdown it would be if I didn't have children. And that's on a stool. And then on the other side of me is a... I might post a picture of this. I've got like an IKEA... what is it, like a sort of almost a laundry chest that's full of books that will never be read again, and I don't know why we've still got them, and I have to move it back and forth every night to get into bed, and then two shoeboxes and a copy of a sort of Alan Moore retrospective holding up. And I did it with a spirit level. It's a great desk. My laptop itself is balanced on two copies of, what are they called? Svar and Trondheim's Dungeon comics, two episodes, the main Zenith mini-series, and the one with, I can't remember what it's called, Duck Hunt. I don't want to lift the mic in case it falls over. But so that's balancing to help the fan on my MacBook. Because it's a MacBook Pro from 2017, it's got two USB-C ports and nothing else, so I've got numerous plugins. I've got my Rode shotgun mic. I don't know why I'm naming this stuff here. I've got my wife's Dell monitor that I've recently hooked up using a VGA to USB-C cable, and that's a life changer. Oh, my God. And I've got my Zoom H6 that is all plugged in. I'm covered in wires and cables. And I'm looking out the window and I'm starting to think, if I move the chat show, if I make it regularly twice a week as I would like to, I'm going to need a permanent setup. I can't keep lugging this up and down two flights of stairs. We live in a squeezy house on a hill, so we're on three floors. It's a narrow, tall house. And I think I'm going to have to rig it all in the cellar where there's no natural light, because it's pretty much the only place I could leave it where it would be that'd be an acceptable sound quality. But it's so dark. Anyway, there's all of that. Here's a couple of emails people sent me. Yucca said this to me. Yucca or Jucca, I'm going with Yucca. I started to listen to the podcast with the same expectation that you started to make it. Learn how comedy is written. I am following your large footsteps through the scary forest. I think I can already see the lantern you're carrying. Turns out I'm also touched by your humanity, not only comedy. Well, thank you, Yucca. I protest too much. I shouldn't have read that last bit out. I normally cut out in bits like that, but thank you. But following the large footsteps through the scary forest, I love a bit of that. I'm going to reiterate a little message. Oh, someone called me. Do you remember? I was so touched a couple of years ago. Someone gave me a thank you card with cash from their first ever paid gig in it, saying that I was the big brother of all open spots. Have I mentioned that before? I love that. I mean, maybe I don't want to be that forever, but it's lovely to be that right now. It's lovely to be that in addition to some other things. But also someone said that I was a sort of digital godfather or something like that. All of these things I absolutely love. And I honestly, I'm just feeling so looked after by the community, and I hope I'm giving enough back, because everyone is crowding round and just being so positive and benevolent to one another. And as I said earlier on, this thing about the chat show, making a thing happen where the whole point of the game is giving back to the people who are in it, I'm just finding it extraordinarily exciting. And just by way of balancing things out, I'm just going to repeat our anonymous police sergeant who who gave these bits of advice. So it's not all just about me basking in this wonderful community that that you're all part of, whether you like it or not. But also, so this is our anonymous police sergeant listener says, remember, don't panic buy. If you pay cleaners or nannies or other people cash in hand for regular work and they no longer work for you because of isolation, consider continuing to pay them. You're essentially their employer and they will have little or no income. Stop congregating outdoors in large groups and really stop panic buying. There are enough loo rolls for everyone if we all buy normally. That's the only mention of the thing we're going to do today. And I've just been invited by the Boutros to play Murder in the Dark. He has been very, very conscientiously letting me record and get on with stuff for the last 4.5 hours. So this postamble is now curtailed. Thanks for listening. Send me your messages. Book me for a lunch date. Do all of that stuff. And look forward to an episode next week with the fabulous Scott Bennett. Check out Scott Bennett on the socials and enjoy everything that he is doing in the privacy of his shed. Bye for now.